Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Part 3. Jim pulled up in front of the SFPD building and parked in the visitor lot. He decided to leave his gun in the car. There was no point in walking into a police station with a loaded firearm, especially when it sounded like Inspector Benari was halfway accusing him of killing Charles. Jim locked the car and headed up the steps to the main lobby. As he walked in, he suddenly realized that he didn't know where to go. He doubted that Benari had already appropriated Charles's desk, and he didn't know where Benari's usual desk was. He decided to walk to the reception and ask for directions. "Hi, Jim Corrigan to see Inspector Benari. He's expecting me." The officer behind the counter picked up a phone and spoke briefly to someone before looking at Jim. "They'll be down for you in a moment, Mr. Corrigan."
"They?" Jim said. "If you're telling me there's going to be four big-ass cops holding me down and beating the crap out of me in a minute, I'm honestly going to be a little pissed off."
"Oh, I doubt that, sir." Jim sighed and leaned against the counter. He hadn't changed clothes after the funeral and was still in his dark suit, but he took the time to loosen his tie while he waited. A few minutes later, Benari and another officer in plain clothes came out of a door and headed right for him with purposeful strides. Jim turned and looked at them.
"Inspector, you could have just told me where I was supposed to go. I've been coming here for a long time."
"And that's something I plan to remedy, Mr. Corrigan. PIs shouldn't have free roam around a police station. But right now, we need to talk, in private. Please, this way."
He gestured to another door, and Jim walked between the two of them. He had an uneasy feeling that they were trying to flank him if he should suddenly try to escape. He was glad he'd left the gun outside. Benari led him through several corridors until they reached an interrogation room. It was the kind of rooms that hadn't changed at all since the time Jim himself had been a police officer. A table, a couple of metal chairs, and a single light source over the table. One wall covered with a two-way mirror so someone could stand in the next room and watch the interrogation. And one thing that Jim was happy to see, an ashtray.
"Sit down, Mr. Corrigan."
Benari sat down on one side of the table and reached into his pocket. Jim sat down on the other side, reached into his own pocket, and pulled out his pack of cigarettes. He lit up, watching the faces of both men contort with anger, yet unable to do anything about it.
"What's this about?" Jim said. "Tell me the whole thing."
"I'm the one asking the questions, if you don't mind, Mr. Corrigan," Benari said.
Jim felt himself getting more annoyed than he liked.
"Look, are you charging me with something? Because in that case, let me hear the charges. Right now, I'd just like you to tell me what happened to Roger."
Benari looked at the other officer and then pulled his hand out of his pocket. In it was a notepad.
"This was on Inspector Charles's desk when he left last night."
Jim looked at the notepad. "Call Jim Corrigan about Zodiac" was printed in Charles's familiar handwriting.
"So? Is that note the reason you think the Zodiac killed him?"
"No, Mr. Corrigan. This is."
The other officer held up a tablet with a picture on it. Jim recognized Charles's car and realized this was a crime scene photo. The officer swiped the picture to the side and another image came up. A close-up of the driver's side door. Something was written on it in black magic marker. San Fran. 03-03-18. By gun.
I'm back.
Over the writing was a symbol that Jim was more than familiar with. A circle with a cross through it, all four tips sticking out over the edge of the circle. It looked like a crosshair in a rifle.
That, said Benari, is the symbol of the Zodiac Killer.
Jim tilted his head to the side and looked at the inspector.
Really? Are you sure? How did you come up with that brilliant piece of police work? From the movies about the Zodiac? The books? The graffiti I've seen around town for the past many years? Please, enlighten me.
Don't be snotty, Corrigan.
Benari looked at him.
He puts your name down and the killer's name, and he's killed less than 15 minutes later by someone using that symbol. That stinks to high heaven.
I agree.
But have you considered the idea that maybe he had suddenly made some kind of landmark discovery and wanted to talk to someone who actually knew something about the case?
Oh, come on, Corrigan. You're not that old.
Benari glared at him.
You're what, 35? You wouldn't even have been a gleam in your daddy's eye when Zodiac was doing his business.
You'd be surprised. I age well. If you check some of the old files, you'd find I was actually a consultant on the case for a while.
The two officers again exchanged looks before the other man spoke.
Look, Mr. Corrigan, maybe we're getting off on the wrong foot here.
I'll say.
First of all, I'm Inspector Secourt, and I apologize if we came on a bit strong.
Look, save the good cop, bad cop routine. I was a cop myself. Just tell me what you know, and I'll tell you what I know. It'll be a whole lot easier if we cooperate on this. Roger was my friend. I want to get to the bottom of this as much as you do. Maybe more.
All right.
Secord handed him the tablet. Take a look at the pictures. We haven't done a handwriting analysis yet, but we've looked at the photos of the car door notes the Zodiac left in 69. To the naked eye, it's a very close match.
Jim looked at the old picture, where the text was. Vallejo, 12-20-68, 7-4-69, September 27th, 69, 6:30, by knife. Above it was the same crosshair symbol.
We've had copycats in the past, or at least people sending us fake letters and phone calls. It's something that's pretty much a part of life in this city,
Secord said. Last night, just before he died, Inspector Charles had a call from one like that. Apparently, it unnerved him so much he had the recording of the call sent to him.
And have you listened to it? Jim said.
Benari mumbled something. Jim put his hand to his ear.
Didn't quite catch that, Inspector.
I said yes, we've listened to it. And it sounds like some kid. Charles thought so, too. He says so in the recording.
Well, I'll be happy to make a voice print, but I can pretty much guarantee you that there's no way my voice will ever sound like a kid's voice.
Jim crossed his arms.
Besides, I've got an alibi for last night. I was working on funeral arrangements with an acquaintance of mine. Would you like me to provide his testimony?
Benari looked like he wanted to say something, but Secord shook his head.
Not at the moment, Mr. Corrigan. I think that perhaps you're right, that we'll get further by cooperating. Now, can you tell us what you know about the Zodiac case that made Inspector Charles want to call you?
Jim dragged on his cigarette.
Well, as I said, I was working with the SFPD back then, in a slightly more unofficial capacity. I didn't work with Inspector Tashi, who led the investigation, though. I had my own leads to follow.
And what sort of leads was that?
I followed up on some rumors that the Zodiac stalked people, sometimes in cars, but mostly on foot. I happened to be very good at following people myself. But, to be completely honest with you, Inspector Secord,
Jim kept his eyes on Secord and ignored Benari completely, which clearly annoyed the man.
What I'm about to tell you can't leave this room. Not only because of client detective privilege, but because it might somewhat incriminate myself. That's not something I enjoy, but I can tell you that what I did to protect someone innocent. Someone who would have had their lives ruined if I'd spoken up in public.
Benari now looked very interested and leaned forward in his chair.
Go on.
Jim kept his eyes on Secord.
Could you send someone to get me something to drink? A soda or something? This might be a long story, and I always get a dry throat when I talk.
Secord looked at Benari.
Would you?
Benari blinked his eyes in surprise.
Are you serious?
Very.
Benari got up and went out the door. Jim was halfway convinced he could see smoke coming out of the man's ears.
How much do you know about me?
Jim asked when the door had closed.
Not a lot. Why?
Because some of what I'm going to tell you might surprise you, change the way you look at the world. I'm not sure if Roger ever shared my backstory with Benari, but there are a few cops around here who know about it. I suppose you'll now be one of them. I'd have preferred to keep Mr. Sunshine there out of it, but I suppose that's out of the question.
Secord almost smiled, but covered his mouth with his hand. I'll see what I can do.
In any event, I doubt Benari will be taking a very active part in the investigation of this case. He's got his hands full with reorganizing and reassigning Inspector Charles's cases.
Sounds good to me.
When Benari returned with three cans of soda, Jim leaned back in his chair, lit another cigarette, and began to talk.
March 22nd, 1970, Patterson, California.
It had been a busy week for Jim. He had been tracking a lost husband who had supposedly been traveling in secret with a clan of vampires across three states, and the job had not been easy. He had gone to the local police station to ask if they had any reports of house break-ins or squatters in the area. Vampires had a habit of squatting in empty houses for a while if they wanted to do something the vampire prince of the city wouldn't approve of. He was talking to the officer at the desk in the front room of the Patterson police station when the woman burst through the door. She was in half hysterics, and in her arms she was carrying a crying infant.
Please,
she said, her voice cracking.
Please help me!
Jim and the cop behind the desk both moved to catch her before she fell over. Jim grabbed her arm and supported her, while the cop gently lifted the baby from her hands and put it on a couch by the window. The baby was crying in soft, exhausted sniffs.
What's wrong? The cop asked. What happened?
There was a man,
the woman panted, then closed her eyes and sobbed.
Here, ma'am, why don't you sit down here with your kid? Jim said. Relax, you're safe now.
Most cops didn't care for private detectives butting in on their turf, but the cop, a middle-aged, overweight man with a walrus mustache, didn't seem to mind in this case. They both helped the woman sit down, and the cop pointed to a door.
Mr. Corrigan, behind that door is a break room, and there's a coffee maker on the counter. Maybe you'd be so kind as to get a cup for the young lady?
Sure.
Jim went quickly through the door, poured a cup of coffee into a cup from a shelf over the sink, and returned to the front room. He didn't put anything in the coffee, but the woman greedily grabbed the cup and drank from it before he could ask her if she took cream or sugar. While he had been gone, the baby had stopped crying. Jim didn't know if it was coming in from the relative cold outside or if it was being put down from the mother's arm that had calmed it.
All right, ma'am. Tell us what happened.
The cop had a rough voice, but he spoke in soothing tones that seemed to calm the woman a bit.
Yes. My name is Kathleen Johns.
I was driving on Highway 132. We'd been to Petaluma and were heading home. A man in a car came up next to us and signaled to pull over, kept pointing to my wheel. I pulled over, but I didn't get out.
Smart. Lots of weird people on the roads, the cop said.
The man came up to my car, and I rolled the window down a bit. He said he could see my back wheel was wobbling. He offered to fix it.
She breathed in and put her hand down to gently touch her baby, who now seemed to almost be asleep.
He told me he'd fixed it, but when I tried to pull back onto the road, the whole wheel came off. He walked up to the car again and said that he would give us a ride to a service station if I wanted.
That sounds suspicious, Jim said. He might actually have loosened the wheel himself.
I thought so, but I was out there with my daughter, and, well, he didn't seem like a scary man. He seemed harmless, nice, and I didn't want to sit at the roadside and wait for some tow truck to pass us by. I had to get to a phone.
Jim didn't say anything. He could hear from Kathleen's voice that she was aware what kind of stupid decision she had made.
We got in his car and we drove off. But he passed the service station, and when I asked him to stop, he just laughed.
She swallowed.
We turned off the highway and onto the back roads, but he was still going fast, very fast. He was talking about what he would do to us. He would kill us both, he said, but my daughter first. He'd make me watch. But in the end, he was turning and slowed down enough that I jumped out. I just took her in my arms and I jumped. I was expecting him to stop, but he kept going. A woman picked me up and drove me here.
What did this guy look like? The cop asked. He had pulled a notepad out of his back pocket.
Around 30 years old, short, dark hair, and heavy-rimmed glasses. Dark suit.
She was obviously seeing the man in her mind, but suddenly raised a hand and pointed to the wall behind the dispatch station.
He looked like that! Just like that!
The cop and Jim both followed her finger. The poster she was pointing to was familiar to Jim. It had been on several front pages in the last few months. It was a phantom drawing of the man who had killed a cab driver in San Francisco and several other people in the Bay Area a short while ago. He had even written letters to the newspapers in code, taunting them to solve it. He called himself the Zodiac. At the same moment, the dispatch radio crackled.
Base, this is Unit 6. I've got an 1124 on Highway 132, east of Bird Road. Over.
Jim had been a cop long before the call codes came into use, but his frequent contact with law enforcement had given him a pretty good idea. 1124 meant an abandoned vehicle. The cop got up and went behind the counter to the radio.
Six, this is Base. Make and model, over.
It's hard to tell, Base. The car's on fire, burning like it was poured full of gasoline. Over.
That's my car, Kathleen whispered. I'm sure of it. He burned it.
Tears rolled down her cheeks now.
Maybe, Jim said. Do you remember what kind of car he was driving?
No, but it was low to the ground and a dark color, black or blue.
Jim patted her hand.
I think you were very lucky, but you're safe now.
Kathleen kept crying, which woke the baby up. They cried together. Jim got to his feet, looking at the cop who was still on the radio.
I'll be back some other time, officer, he said. I've just remembered I've got something to do.
The cop didn't respond, but the look that passed between them seemed like he had some kind of clue what was on Jim's mind, and that he didn't want to stop him. Jim went out the door and to his car in a brisk walk. When he got in, he looked at his road map and started his car, heading for Highway 132 and Bird Road. It took him maybe 15 minutes to cover the distance,
but long before he got there, he could see the light from the burning car. He was glad that the spring had been relatively cold and wet, so the fields had no real chance of catching fire. He could see the flashes from the police cruiser parked on the road from far away and stopped about half a mile from the burning car. He turned off the engine and looked around for spirits. It was a lonely stretch of road, so he didn't expect there to be many, but sometimes accidents and crime scenes drew spirits just like the regular living looky-loos. In this case, he could spot a couple by the road, looking at the burning car with interest. "Come," he whispered, reaching out to them. "Come to me. Talk to me." A couple of the spirits seemed to respond and moved closer. After a few minutes, a woman approached the car and stood next to him. Jim got out slowly and stood in front of her.
"Did you see the man who did this?" he said. "Did you see the man who burned the car?"
She nodded and pointed down the road.
"Yes, I know he left. I need you to tell me about the car he was driving. What it looked like, what kind of car it was, and maybe even where it went."
The woman looked hesitant, but he smiled, trying to instill confidence.
"It's all right. I can actually hear you if you speak. Try."
The woman's voice was thin and low, as if the wind in his ears was forming words. It was obviously not easy for her to talk.
"Black Chevy."
"Anything special about it?"
She nodded.
"There is a red pillow in the rear window."
"A pillow?
Why do you want to know?"
"Do you remember the license plate?"
Jim asked without much hope. It wasn't exactly the kind of information spirits normally looked at. The woman shook her head.
"All right. And it went that way?" Jim said, pointing north.
She nodded, and Jim sighed. That way was Tracy, Stockton, and many smaller towns. Not to mention that if one turned west, one would eventually come to San Francisco itself. It wasn't exactly a good lead to follow, since the guy had a decent head start. The woman gestured to him and pointed down the road.
"Yes, I'm going to follow him, but it's not going to be easy. I don't know where he's going."
The woman nodded, then pointed to herself. Jim's eyes widened.
"You know where he's going?"
"Yes."
"Tell me then,"
he said, a bit forcefully, and the woman backed up a step.
"Sorry, but if this guy is who I think he is, he's very dangerous. I read about him, the Zodiac."
"I know him."
The woman's voice was still soft, but now had a hint of sorrow.
"He lived next door to me before."
"Before you died? Are you kidding me?"
Jim said, feeling his stomach tighten with excitement.
"You actually know who he is and where he is? This is better than I could have hoped for. Will you tell me?"
The woman looked at him for a moment, considering.
"What will you do?"
"I'll make sure he doesn't hurt anyone again."
She didn't look like that inspired more confidence in her, but she concentrated and whispered.
"I lived at Jubilee Drive in Brentwood. He lives there, too, with his family."
Jim felt a shiver run down his back. He had never imagined a person like the Zodiac having a family. From the twisted letters he had read in the papers, he thought he would be a weird, lonely man. But if he had a family... The woman looked like she felt guilty for telling. Jim smiled at her.
"I'm very glad you told me. I promise to go and look into this very discreetly. I won't do anything until I'm absolutely sure he's the man I want. Okay?"
"All right,"
she whispered.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jim got back in his car, but before he closed the door, he looked at her one last time.
Thank you. You've been a great help.
The woman didn't reply, but turned back her eyes to the now smoldering wreck. Jim started the car and drove off. As he sped toward Brentwood, he let his mind work on the problem. Could it really be this easy? That a spirit had recognized the man he was after? Of course, this was a clue that no one else in the country would ever be able to use, much less believe. He couldn't tell the police. Even if he went to the SFPD and explained about his skills, there was no way they would believe him if he accused some random person of being the Zodiac without solid evidence. He had to handle this entirely on his own. When he got to Brentwood, he parked his car in a lot by a service station and walked to Jubilee Drive. It was a quiet street close to a small park. The houses were large and well-kept, with lawns that, in the early morning light, seemed to glitter with melting frost. Jim walked up the street, looking at the houses and the garages in particular. The woman hadn't given him a specific address, so he had to hope the Zodiac parked his car outside. He would have come home fairly early in the morning, so there was a chance he hadn't bothered putting the car into a garage. Halfway up the street, he spotted a black Chevy in a driveway. When he got closer, he noticed the red pillow in the rear window, and his pulse began to beat faster. He looked around, making sure the street was still early morning empty. It wouldn't be for long. The sun would be up soon, and people would begin preparing for the workday. But right now, he was alone. He knelt down next to the car and looked at the tires and body. He hadn't had a chance to make a tire track analysis at the crime scene, but he spotted a lot of mud and splatters on the car's wheel wells and lower parts of the doors. That would have been consistent with driving around the back roads, as Kathleen had said her kidnapper had done. Jim's eyes scanned the house and garden. The mailbox said Paulson. There were a couple of children's bicycles in the front yard, casually leaning against a bush. Judging from the size of the house, Jim wouldn't be surprised if a family with two or three kids lived here. He didn't dare go in and get the man inside. He would be nothing but a home invader if he did. He would have to wait until the guy came out. He got to his feet and walked a little further up the street, still making sure he kept an open line of sight to the house, until he found a good hiding place. A pair of dense bushes and trees had been planted between two houses, and in one of the trees was a small tree house. It was the kind of tree house that looked like kids had built it themselves instead of getting their parents to help them. The roof was plastic, and the walls were made of boards of various sizes, not two of them the same color. A stepladder led to a hatch in the bottom of the house. Jim looked around again and quickly climbed up the ladder and into the tree house. He almost got stuck in the opening, but managed to wiggle inside. It was painfully obvious to him that even though he might be immortal, he wasn't 12 anymore. The treehouse was cold and damp, and the comforts of summer had long been moved inside. There wasn't even a chair to sit on, but Jim didn't care. He got as comfortable as he could on the floor and kept an eye on his target through a small window. The morning came, and the street came to life. People left their houses. Cars pulled out of garages or away from the curb. A school bus drove through the street and picked up several kids. In the Paulson house,
A light came on in the kitchen at about 7. Half an hour later, an attractive young woman walked out of the house and down the street. She was wearing a Dairy Queen uniform, and Jim assumed she worked at the one he'd passed only a few blocks away. At 7:50 a.m., the door opened and two little girls came out, followed by a man in a suit. Jim looked at him, squinting his eyes. He had dark hair, that much was obvious. He got in the car, and the girls climbed in the back seat. A moment later, the engine started, and the car pulled out of the driveway. Jim waited until it was gone before climbing out of his hiding place. He moved back across the road and walked into the front yard, walking as if he had every right to be there. The front door was locked, and when he went around back, he found the kitchen door locked as well. It didn't take him long to pick the lock. The house was quiet, and as Jim moved through the rooms, being careful not to leave any fingerprints, the first thing he noticed was how neat the house was. If two little girls lived there, you expected at least some form of clutter or mess, but it looked like the house came right out of the Homes and Gardens magazine. There wasn't a spoon out of place in the kitchen, and the living room looked immaculate. When he moved upstairs, he found that this order and tidiness was even found in the rooms the children lived in. Toys were neatly put away, and the beds were made. When he came to the bedroom, Jim was even more careful. He pulled his sleeves out over his hands, as he'd not brought gloves. Slowly, he began to search drawers and nightstands. On a shelf on one side of the bed, he noticed a framed wedding photo. In this, he saw that the man wasn't wearing glasses, but did indeed have dark hair. Jim didn't think he looked very much like the phantom drawing of Zodiac. For a moment, he considered if the spirit had lied to him. But why would she? She didn't know him from Adam. Then he remembered one of the Zodiac's letters printed in the paper, where the man had told the police that the sketch was useless. "I only look like that when I do my thing. The rest of the time, I look completely different," he had written. He found nothing in the room that made him suspicious before he reached the nightstand on what was apparently Mr. Paulson's side. When he pulled the drawer out, there was something about the shape of it that bothered him. It was almost like the drawer was too shallow. He looked closer and discovered that it had a second bottom. When he lifted the false bottom up, he found a leather glasses case beneath it, which turned out to contain a pair of black, heavy-framed glasses. When he held them up to his eye, he noticed they had no prescription. They were just acting glasses, made with window glass. "Now, why would you have a pair of glasses without prescription?" he mumbled to himself, and looked deeper in the drawer. In the back, some fabric was curled up in a ball. When he pulled it out and looked more closely, he almost gasped. There was no doubt in his mind now. Mr. Paulson was the Zodiac. He had to be. When the Zodiac had shot and killed cab driver Paul Stein, he had taken a piece of Stein's bloody shirt with him. He had sent a part of it to the police, along with a letter proving that he was the killer. In the bottom of the drawer lay a small blue-and-white striped piece of fabric with splatters of blood on it. It was the rest of Paul Stein's shirt piece. Later that day, Jim was back in his car, watching the Paulson house from across the street. He realized that it was a risky move. People tended to remember a man in a parked car, but he pulled his hat down over his brow and pretended to be asleep. If someone came up to him, he would show them his private investigator license and tell them he was doing a stakeout. At 3, the two little girls got off the school bus and went into the house. Obviously, their daddy didn't drive them home, Jim thought. He waited for the parents to come home, and at 4, the mother returned. At 5, the black Chevy appeared. It parked in the driveway, and Mr. Paulson got out. He was still in his suit and carrying a briefcase. Jim got out of the car and walked across the road towards him.
"Mr. Paulson?"
he asked in a relaxed voice when he was a few steps away from him. Paulson turned around and looked at him.
"Yes, can I help you?"
"I'm sure you can." Jim stepped even closer. "Just like I'm sure you know why I'm here. I'd like you to walk down to my car with me and take a ride. We've got things to discuss, Zodiac." Jim could see how Paulson's body under the suit tensed and his eyes darted back and forth across the street. Jim's eyes fixed on his and held his gaze. His face was carefully neutral, but the voice was as cold as a river in January.
Don't even bother. Do you want them to know what you did, who you are?"
Paulson didn't answer, but his hand crept toward his pocket.
"Don't," Jim said. "Not here. Not where your family can see you. If you want to hold on to whatever dignity you have left, and you want them to grow up without knowing what their father and husband did, then do what I say and get in the car with me. Right now. If you don't, I'll shoot you down on your own front lawn like a dog."
Paulson's hands stopped moving. His lips had become almost entirely white.
"All right."
He began to walk toward Jim's car, and Jim followed, still making sure he looked relaxed and smiling. This was just two friends walking to a car together, as far as anyone who saw them would think. Paulson got in the shotgun seat, and Jim sat behind the wheel. He started the engine and drove off down the street, turned the corner, and headed out to the larger road. Paulson sat silently on the seat next to him, looking straight ahead. He didn't speak for a few miles until they passed the city limits.
"Are you not taking me to the police?"
Jim's friendly smile had left his face.
"I think we can agree that this has gone a little beyond the police at this point. Am I right?"
Paulson sighed.
"Yes, I suppose so. How did you find me?"
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you. Let's just say I was tipped off." They drove in silence for a few minutes until Jim saw a road sign and turned off the road onto a small back road leading to a lake and picnic area. It was empty, and when he parked the car, he could hear birds singing.
"Why'd you do it?" Jim asked. "That's what I'm curious about. I've hunted men who did some crazy stuff, but they all had a reason. What's yours?"
Paulson looked through the windshield at the lake in front of them.
"Do you believe in a life after death?" he said. "I'm the absolute last person in the world you should ask that question," Jim said. "You wouldn't like my answer, but go on."
"I had a near-death experience as a child, a drowning accident. I saw what lay beyond. I saw the afterlife. It is not heaven. It is hell, a place of darkness and pain and suffering. And I saw that there are rulers and subjects there, just like on Earth. But you can make yourself a ruler, because anyone you kill ends up serving you in the next world. They become your slaves. You draw power from them. One of the rulers there told me what to do."
Jim had to bite his lip not to set the man's record straight.
"That was how it started," Paulson said. "But I found out that I liked it. I enjoyed the fear and terror in their eyes. I enjoyed killing women who had it coming and the men they had with them. I did not care so much about the men, though. The women make better slaves."
"So you knew them, the women? Or how did you know they had it coming?"
"Some of them I knew.
Others, you just get the feeling sometimes. You see someone and know she deserves it.
Okay, but then why did you kill the taxi driver? He wasn't a woman who had it coming.
He was just a random one. I felt like it, that is all. My wife was away with the girls for the weekend, and I felt like killing someone. I went up to the city and just...
He gestured with his hands as if it didn't matter.
Found someone useless. Someone who would make a good slave.
You've got a family at home, Jim said. You care about your reputation remaining unblemished, am I right?
You are right, Paulson sighed. If the kids found out, they would be... No, I would not want them to know.
Then, this is my suggestion. You'll disappear. Nobody will ever hear from you again. You'll become a mystery yourself. Someone who one day just didn't come home from work and who vanished into thin air, and not someone who killed a bunch of people. Your family will go on and live their lives. No one will ever know you were the Zodiac. What do you say?
Paulson looked at him, his face almost relieved. If I promise to disappear, you will let me go?
Yes. Jim looked at him. But I'd be watching you. As you can see, I know how to find you. No matter where you went, you'd know I'd be watching you and making sure you didn't go back to your old ways. Come on, get out of the car.
Paulson opened the side door and got out. Jim opened his own and got out on his side. Who are you? Paulson asked. How did you find me? Honestly.
I'm Jim Corrigan, and I'm a private investigator. As to how I found you, it's not important. What's important is that you'll never kill again.
Paulson came around the car to Jim's side. He still looked relieved. I hope, that you will not see me kill again. Jim saw his hand move again toward his pocket, but didn't do anything. He had expected this. It was what he wanted.
In fact, I can promise you, you will never see me kill again after today,
Paulson said, suddenly moving his hand to the pocket and back in a blur of motion. A short handle appeared in his fingers, and as he moved it forward, a click sounded. A long, thin stiletto blade emerged from the handle and plunged into Jim's stomach. Even though he was prepared for it, he doubled over. Immortal or not, being stabbed still hurt. Paulson twisted the blade around, pushing Jim back. Jim staggered a couple of steps and put his own hand into his pocket, grabbing the handle of the gun he kept there. He raised it and fired a single shot. The many years of training had made Jim a crack shot. Paulson's head jerked back as the bullet went into his forehead. It did not emerge on the other side. For a moment, he stood upright with the knife still raised. Then he dropped to the ground and lay still. Jim put his hand on his stomach. He could already feel the wound begin to close, his body healing itself, but it would hurt for a few hours. Had he been mortal, it would likely have killed him. As it was, his biggest concern was that his shirt had been ruined. He walked to the dead body and looked at it for a moment. He had known what he would have to do from the moment he'd seen Paulson, but he had felt the need to let Paulson make the first move. It seemed fairer, somehow. Back when he had been a cop, he would have called what he'd just done vigilante justice. But now he thought of it as a necessity. No one else in the police would have been able to know that Paulson was the Zodiac. He'd hidden his tracks too well. Jim was the only judge who could sentence him to a punishment fitting his crime. He hadn't lied, however. Paulson's family would never find out that he had been a serial killer. Not from Jim, at least. A thought occurred to Jim as he lifted the body into his trunk, wrapping it in a blanket. If the Zodiac never wrote another letter, maybe there would still be some kind of link to Paulson's disappearance. He would have to write a letter himself and make sure the police got it. That way, the Zodiac would at least have lived until after Paulson's disappearance. He'd go to the SFPD himself, offer some help with the case, trying to keep the investigation alive for a while longer, so he could steer it away from Paulson, if need be. Jim got back in his car. He checked the road map for a place to dispose of a body. It wouldn't be easy, but he figured he could find one before he continued the hunt for the vampires. Benari and Secord sat for a while after Jim had stopped talking and just stared at him. Secord's mouth was halfway open, making him look like a boy watching the fireworks show. Benari looked like he didn't know if he should laugh or pull out the handcuffs. "Do you have any evidence to back this story up?" Benari asked, after clearing his throat a couple of times. "I could say that I kept a piece of Stein's shirt. To be honest, I actually considered going back for it afterward, but decided against it in the end. As I said before, this doesn't leave this room. I realize there is no statute of limitations for a homicide in California, but if you insist on dragging this case to court, it'll be one hell of a media circus. You would have to prove I was actually an immortal and that what I just said was true, which would be next to impossible. You'll never find a body, and I doubt there would be a court in this country who would allow you to try and kill me to prove that I'm immortal." Benari swallowed, but said nothing. "Yes, I said immortal, Inspector. Roger knew about me. I suppose it's only fair for you to know, too, if you're going to sit in his chair, even for a brief time. Cooperation is really in your best interest. Both of our best interests, actually." "I don't believe," Benari began, but Secord leaned forward over the table. His eyes were alight with wonder. "How did you become immortal? How does one... I mean, is it like a curse? Did you drink a potion or something?" "That's a rather long and personal story, which I don't feel like sharing. It has no relevance to this case anyway." "Can you prove that you're immortal?" Benari asked. "Can you give me actual proof that you were there?" "You could always look up some of Inspector Tashi's old call sheets. We spoke a few times, although, as I said, we never exactly worked together. I'll most likely be listed as Mr. C. And of course, there's the photo from the police party in 1978. It should be in your files somewhere. That was a hell of a party. But to return to the point of my story, the Zodiac is dead, period. Whoever killed Roger had to have been someone else, a copycat killer." Benari cleared his throat again. Mr. Corrigan, your story is interesting, but doesn't really hold up as evidence without me reviewing all the old stuff you mentioned. But I'm willing to take your word for it, for now, that you did indeed help locate the original Zodiac. But we're still left with the same question. Who did kill Inspector Charles?" "That's exactly what I'm going to find out. I won't impede your investigation. All I ask is freedom to run my own. If you find any leads, keep me in the loop, and I'll do the same." Jim winked one eye at the men. "Even if, as you said, my stories aren't exactly evidence." The two inspectors looked at each other. "Fine." Benari's voice was less sulky than before, but it was clear he still didn't like the situation. "Agreed. I'll make sure you get access to whatever finds we make, and you do the same for us. You will report to Secord should you find anything worth investigating. Strictly unofficial capacity." Jim got to his feet and pulled a fresh cigarette from his pack, sticking it between his lips without lighting it. "Gentlemen,
I wouldn't have it any other way. If you send the case file to me, I'll be in touch.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.